instead of having a policy against this and trying to remove this various terrorist content, that Twitter had just said, let 1,000 flowers bloom, we're not going to touch a thing. But, you know, it knows that all of this is happening, but it just, it does not have a policy of trying to remove. Then do you fall within the language of the statute?
I don't think so.
Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan questioning Twitter attorney Seth Waxman during oral arguments today. For the second day in a row, the Supreme Court heard a case that sits at the intersection of tech laws and U.S. anti-terrorism laws. Today's case against Twitter asks whether social media companies can be sued for allowing terrorist groups to put dangerous content on their platforms. Yesterday, a case against Google touched on whether social media companies can face liability because their algorithms promote similar extremist content. Both cases were brought by families of people killed abroad in ISIS terrorist attacks, and both have the potential to reshape the internet. They focus on a small but powerful section of the Communications Decency Act, known as Section 230, loathed by both Republicans and Democrats. Republicans say that Section 230 allows tech companies to muzzle conservative opinions. Democrats say it lets fascists and terrorists spread their extremist speech and helps radicalize people sympathetic to those views. We're going to talk about this now with Tim Wu, professor of law, science, and technology at Columbia Law School. And he argues that repealing Section 230 won't do what either party wants. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
All right, so broadly speaking, oh, it's great to have you back. Broadly speaking, this section shields sites like YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, et cetera, from facing legal liability for the content their users publish. But let's say I posted something that urged people to do something really violent, like shoot up a school, and then someone did that. Why shouldn't Twitter or any of these tech companies be held responsible? Because isn't that the equivalent of handing me a loaded gun?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I think people have generally started to wonder as these companies have moved on from being little startups that people seem to like to becoming some of the world's most valuable companies, whether they should have some more accountability for the stuff that's on their platforms. You know, the case that you just described, someone urges someone to do something, sort of metaphor analogy, I guess, that the platforms would bring up is something like the telephone system. Obviously, people plan crimes all the time over the telephone system, and we've sort of never said the telephone should be liable, or, you know, people use baseball bats to break in windows and stuff. But obviously, it's a little more complicated than that. But, you know, that's sort of the beginning of the discussion. Mm-hmm. As it stands, they're not liable, although they could be. There's an exception for criminal law, which I'll just mention quickly.
Right. Okay, but I guess the pushback on that is that, okay, it's not a baseball bat company, but it's a communications company. And so that traditional publishers do have face this kind of liability, but these internet companies are not facing the same kinds of liability. Why not?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so, you know, For example, the radio, which we're on now, mm-hmm. the radio station bears liability if I were to defame someone. I'm not planning on doing that.
Thank you.
And newspapers have the same situation, so do television stations and networks. So there's been an argument, I think this has gathered a lot of steam, suggesting, you know, it's not really fair why all these other businesses have to sort of make sure that the people that they host don't break the law. Why shouldn't the big tech platforms have to do the same thing? The tech platforms, for their part, say, well, you know, have you noticed there's a billion searches a day? There's, you know, millions, billions of videos uploaded every minute. And if we're strictly liable for all of them, that just creates an insane situation where the internet, as you know it, doesn't really work. Yeah.
Okay, so let's go back in time, because the original intent way back in 1996, and this is in part of the Communications Decency Act, was to shield people from accessing offensive and indecent content, mainly porn, on the internet, right? It's basically to help platforms say, you know, if you take this off because it's offensive and maybe young kids could see it, then you won't be sued for doing that. So, right? That was the original intent. So how did it morph into this, what it is now, where platforms can essentially do just the opposite, allow offensive content to flourish without consequence?
So if we move ourselves back to the 90s, and some of you listeners will remember like AOL and chat rooms and dial-up internet and all kinds of things almost lost to history, they were facing two problems. Congress was facing two problems. One was the problem that I described earlier. Companies like AOL were saying, well, you know, it's not really possible for us to keep track of, you know, hundreds of or thousands of chat rooms, what everyone's saying. And if we're strictly liable for something that anyone posts on a bulletin board or says in a chat room, you know, there's just no way to do this. We're much more like the phone network or maybe like a hotel or something, where it's just like a lot of people do a lot of stuff. It's crazy for us to be strictly liable for everything. At the same time, Congress also wanted to create a rule that didn't punish people for taking down offensive content. Back in the 90s, there was an enormous concern, as you said, about offensive and pornography and obscenity on the internet. And so they wanted, so they created this kind of law that did both, which created an immunity meant for the small companies or AOL, companies like that. And then also said, well, you're never liable for taking stuff down. And it's the first one that we're focused on. There were always both there. The first one has become much more legally relevant. So that's kind of how we got here.
Yeah. So you're arguing that it won't actually do what people want it to do if we got rid of Section 230, that it wouldn't address either side's complaints, as I outlined earlier in the intro, that liberals don't like it because then tech companies can spread all of this, you know, malicious content, and conservatives don't like it because they feel muzzled. So you're saying that if the court strikes it down, neither side will be happy. Why?
Yeah, well, I don't think there's any court strikes going to strike it down. But let me answer the question. I think, you know, it's a very confusing area. And I think liberals and conservatives have both decided, especially politically, that they don't love big tech. And one of the things to do is to repeal 230 because, you know, it seems like they're getting special treatment. But it's not really clear that repealing 230. So, and let me say further, liberals tend to want to repeal it because, like, the internet's full of Nazis and craziness and election deniers, and that's bad. And the conservatives have the view that, you know, these big liberal websites in California are censoring conservatives and so on. So both of them are mad, but there's no real connection between repealing 230 and either of those goals. For better or for worse, hate speech and people promoting the Nazi party is still speech protected by the First Amendment, like it or not. And for the conservatives, even worse, if you got rid of Section 230 and suddenly anything that is potentially defamatory should be taken down, then you're going to see the sites take much more content down. So it's not really it's sort of a proxy war. I know it's very confusing. I'm sure some listeners are like, well, what is it? And I think the Supreme Court justice is very confused yesterday and today as to what this all means. Yeah, I don't think it really is actually the right tree for anyone to be barking up, honestly. There's some exceptions, but for the reasons people want, it's not the right tree.
Right, because then it would unleash a bunch of lawsuits, right? Of if I, like, defame my boss and say she's a fascist on Twitter, then my boss could sue Twitter. And she's not a fascist, by the way.
Okay, good. Quite
the opposite.
Yes, that's right. And so the moment Twitter saw anything even borderline defamatory, I think they'd take it down to be safe. So you'd have a huge number of takedowns. So I think that would be, I think conservatives would get the opposite of what they want, would be a much more censorial space. I think they wouldn't really like that. I mean, I'll say, I do think there should be some, my own view on this, if you're interested, is I do think it should be slightly modified, that sort of blanket immunity is a little too much. You know, we're way beyond the 90s and, for example, AI-created content is really content that the platforms are creating. So I think the immunity goes too far, but I'm afraid to say that neither liberal or conservatives would get what they want if the law were repealed.
Tim Wu is a professor of law, science, and technology at Columbia Law School and author of the book, The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. Tim, always great to have you on. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Coming up, why one of the nation's largest evangelical churches, Saddleback, here in Orange County, was expelled by its parent organization. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Southern Baptist Convention expelled one of its largest and most prominent members this week, Saddleback Church, here in Southern California. The move comes almost 2 years after Saddleback's founding pastor, Rick Warren, ordained three women as ministers. Then he retired. Warren's appointments did not sit well with the convention leadership. Their statement of belief says explicitly that, quote, the office of pastor is limited to men as qualified by scripture. Ruth Graham is covering this story for the New York Times. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you.
All right. So this church was founded by Rick Warren back in 1980. He led the church for 40 years before he retired a couple of years ago. And he is extremely influential. He meets with presidents and has built this church up to be massive. What did he do on his way out when he appointed these women as ministers?
Yeah, it was really interesting. I mean, the month before he announced that he would be retiring, the church ordained these three women. They put the photo online, they called it historic, but really no big announcements beyond that, and not even really a lot of clarity on what their exact titles are. They're not listed as like head pastors of a Saddleback location, but clearly, you know, the church sees this as a historic thing to ordain these women as pastors. Pretty much right after that, Rick Warren announces that he's going to retire the following year. And then the next year, when that retirement comes around, he announces his successors as Andy and Stacy Wood. And they're a couple who lead a church or who led a church in the San Francisco area. Andy is the lead pastor, but Stacy is a teaching pastor. And now, as they've taken over leadership at Saddleback after Rick Warren's retirement, she preaches sometimes on Sunday. And Sunday mornings. And all of this is sort of flirting with the edges of sort of a broad agreement in the you know, part of conservative evangelicalism that Saddleback is a part of, that this role of head pastor and teaching pastor is reserved for men. And like you said, it's actually explicit within the Southern Baptist Convention. So he's sort of pushing those boundaries a little bit mm-hmm. on his way out.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. And so this church has around 20,000 people a week. So it's a huge membership. What was their reaction to the hiring of women ministers?
Well, you know, they seem to have welcomed, there's no revolt that we know of from within mm-hmm. the church. So they seem to have welcomed, the Woods, who are still there coming on a year later. And again, you know, Stacy preaching somewhat regularly, but within the denomination, it's received differently. The Southern Baptist Convention is huge, 47,000 churches across the United States, millions of members. And a lot of those churches are more conservative theologically and more conservative culturally than Saddleback. So there's immediately real pushback from within the denomination to these moves. So they're discussed at the Southern Baptist Convention meets every summer, and they've been discussed for the last two meetings. And then just in February, it was a smaller leadership committee, the executive committee that voted formally to, you know, expel the church from the denomination.
What does that mean for the church to be expelled?
You know, so in some ways, not a lot. Saddleback doesn't even use the term Baptist in its name. My guess is that a lot of regular attendees and members don't even know that they're attending a Southern Baptist church. It's a pretty loose, they own their own property. It won't be like a difficult, messy divorce in those terms. symbolically, it's big for the Southern Baptist Convention to cut off such a huge church from its body and to sort of say, you know, no, we're drawing this theological line here, and that's more important than any donations we might receive from you, any kind of reflected glory of this huge church being a member of the SBC. But I think for people attending Saddleback on Sunday mornings, it won't mean a lot.
But it wasn't just Saddleback, right? There were four other churches with women in leadership positions in Kentucky, Mississippi, Georgia, and Maryland also expelled.
Right.
So what was the response to this? It seems like a bigger move now.
It is. And it is clearly the denomination kind of drawing a line in the sand here. And it's not as clear cut, I think, as some people in the denomination would like to say. I mean, women can be, you know, children's ministers, children's pastors in a lot of these settings without causing controversy. It's really this bigger question of what is a pastor? What does that title mean? What is the level of pastoral leadership that's reserved only for men, and what are women able to take part in? And it's not quite as neat and tidy as I think some people would want to see it as. So this is going to start. It's not a new conversation, but it's certainly going to sort of revive that controversy and likely be a big topic at the larger meeting this summer, and within evangelicalism more broadly.
Right. So this is actually, I suppose, a big signpost as to where evangelical Christianity in this country is headed. And it seems, at least on this front, in a more conservative direction.
I think that's fair. You know, the SBC is in some ways a very diverse denomination, and they're going to hash it out over this. They're going to disagree. They're going to discuss it. But they do all get in a room every summer and talk it through. So I think there will be some disagreement. There's pretty broad long-term agreement, I should say, on this question of men, the head pastor position being reserved for men. And Saddleback has not exactly come forward and said, you know, we believe women should be able to be head pastors. They're just kind of pushing the boundaries a little bit in the edges. Some of the smaller churches that were also expelled this week do have women in the top leadership roles. And it will be interesting to see if they come forward. They're able to appeal this summer at the convention. And it will be really interesting to watch if any of them choose to do that.
Yeah. Ruth Graham covers faith, religion, and values for the New York Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, why some Jews say anti-abortion laws discriminate against their freedom of religion.
They would still oppose having strict abortion laws because, again, they consider that to be something that a pregnant person should decide with her rabbi and not because of the state's laws.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Christians were key to getting Roe v. Wade overturned. They worked for decades to chip away at the right to an abortion, which culminated in last summer's Dobbs decision. Since then, many Republican-led states have implemented total or near-total bans on abortion. Now, some Jews and Muslims are fighting in court, saying their religious freedom to have an abortion is being compromised. Abby Vasoulis wrote about this for Mother Jones, where she's a national politics reporter. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So your story focuses on a woman named Lisa Sobel. She lives in Louisville, Kentucky. And she and her husband tried to have a baby for several years. They spent tens of thousands of dollars on in vitro fertilization. And finally, she delivered a healthy baby girl a few years ago, but she almost died after hemorrhaging, and now she wants to have another child, but she says that Kentucky's anti-abortion laws, which are newly enacted, really stand in the way of her getting pregnant and in a way that's compatible with her religious beliefs. Tell us more about what she's arguing.
Yeah, so Lisa had a really traumatizing experience having her first child, and she was really excited to have that child, but now that she is wanting to have one more child, she fears that Kentucky's strict abortion laws prevent her from doing so because They're vague, they're kind of contradictory. One law says that doctors should make reasonable medical efforts to preserve both the life of a mother and the life of a fetus. But another one says that physicians should abort a fetus if a mother faces substantial and irreversible impairment to a major bodily function. And there have been several cases in other states with similar abortion laws, like Texas, where doctors have kind of paused and not provided care to speed up a miscarriage because they're afraid of violating these confusing and strict abortion laws. So Lisa fears that if she were, again, hemorrhaging or bleeding out, that doctors in Kentucky might also pause and not provide her that immediate life-saving care until she reached a point where there was clear risk of death. So that's one part. But then another part of her struggle and her reason for hesitating and pursuing IVF again is that Lisa fears that Kentucky's laws are not exactly crystal clear on what constitutes a fetus and what constitutes human life. So the conservative Christian viewpoint, which is baked into a lot of these strict anti-abortion laws, is that life begins at conception. But Jewish people and Muslim people and even a lot of non-conservative Christians don't believe that. They don't think that life begins at conception. They feel that life begins at birth. And so, you know, if life begins at conception, then technically when an egg is fertilized, even if it's in a lab, such as the case in IVF, then are you allowed to discard of those fertilized eggs? Lisa says, and her lawyers say, that it's unclear whether Kentucky's laws allow that. But a lot of times with IVF, there are excess fertilized embryos. And there are also sometimes embryos that test positive for genetic conditions that are incompatible with life. So Lisa doesn't know whether it would be okay to dispose of those embryos that are not compatible with life or that are just too plentiful. She doesn't need six fertilized embryos. She might only need one.
So talk about the religious basis for this argument, because you describe her as devoutly religious. She's not just culturally Jewish. She actually is practicing her faith. So what is her argument using the Torah or the Talmud? What is her argument?
So most Jewish people, the resounding majority of practicing Jewish people in the United States, might point to something like Exodus, which describes, you know, a physical altercation in which a woman is inadvertently injured, and there's two outcomes in that section of the Exodus. And it says, one says, if fighting men were to strike a pregnant woman and cause her fetus to miscarry, but do not cause further injury to the woman, the penalty is a monetary fine. So if the fetus were to die, the penalty is a monetary fine. However, if the woman carrying the fetus was further harmed, the punishment would be an eye for an eye or even a life for a life. So a lot of Jewish and non-conservative Christians look to that and say, okay, there is a clear distinction between the penalty for harming a fetus and the penalty for harming a woman. Another thing that a lot of Jewish and non-conservative Christians point to is that there are several places in the Old Testament that equate life with breath. So when a baby is born and a God breathes life into them through their nostrils, that is when they become a human. And so a lot of Jewish people, including Lisa, say that means that if they were to need to have an abortion, whether it's for their physical health or their mental health or just what is right for them, then that would be allowed. And the U.S. Constitution and also state constitutions, including Kentucky's, have statutes that say that you have the freedom to exercise your own religion, and you also have the freedom to live in a state or in a country where there is not an established religion that is set for everybody through law.
But even before Dobbs, when Roe v. Wade was the law of the land, there were restrictions on abortion. So you couldn't get an abortion until the moment of birth, right? There were always time restrictions on abortions. So how does that square with the religious belief that life begins at birth?
Mm-hmm. So just because people are Jewish or Muslim doesn't mean that they would support abortion up until the point of birth. But especially in the early weeks of pregnancy, a lot of Jewish people support basically abortion on demand or abortion as necessary. It's totally a choice, because in the Talmud, there's even scripture that says that for the first 40 days of a pregnancy, a fetus is considered mere water. Now that we know that that's not literally the case, because we have ultrasound technology and things like that, that's not necessarily interpreted literally. But still, in the very early stages of pregnancy, a lot of people of faith will say that really the woman's decision comes first. And there's also, you know, a verse in the Talmud that talks about what to be done when a pregnant person is delivering a baby and the baby is more than halfway out. And it's kind of a graphic description, but basically what it means is that, like, if a baby is less than halfway delivered, then the mother's life takes full precedence, and doctors and midwives and whoever around the pregnant person delivering should do whatever is in their power to save the pregnant delivering person's life. However, the Talmud says that if the fetus is more than halfway out, then they should be considered almost equal. And then at that point, they would no longer be okay with disposing of a fetus at will, because it's already more than halfway out of the pregnant person's body. And also, I mean, like, Orthodox Jewish people would also not support abortion on demand, as some conservatives may call the right to have an abortion. But they would still oppose, in most cases, having strict abortion laws, because, again, they consider that to be something that a pregnant person should decide with her rabbi and not because of the state's laws.
Mm. Okay, so they're also arguing, though, a secular argument, right, that they're looking at the First Amendment and they're saying it's not these actual words, but the clear intent of the separation of church and state in the Establishment Clause, and that a lot of these laws were constructed with a religious intent, and maybe in certain cases in Missouri, an overtly religious intent. The bill's author said, "I'm a Catholic, this is what I believe," and we built that into our legislative findings. And the total ban says, "Almighty God is the author of life, and that the life of each human begins at conception." So are they also arguing that, well, first of all, you know, aside from the fact that we have these other religious beliefs, this is just a violation of the First Amendment?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clearly invoking a narrow version of Christianity into law in all of these states. I mean, especially in Missouri, where they did invoke Almighty God and say that life begins at conception, which, again, is not a universally scientific held belief or a universally held belief among all religions. But in Florida, even, Governor Ron DeSantis enacted Florida's 15-week abortion ban into law, not in the state capitol building, but in a church, in an evangelical church. But the issue is that it's up to the courts to decide what is a violation of someone's First Amendment rights. But in these cases, because they're being argued in state courts, whether these laws are in violation of the state constitution's free exercise and other religious rights. So, you know, if we were to look to U.S. courts to kind of predict what will happen, there are some good examples of justices, even conservative justices, saying that if you're going to have an exemption for anything, then you also need to consider having exemptions for faith. And so one example in the 1990s was this, the Fraternal Order of Police was challenging Newark, New Jersey's police uniform code. So Newark, New Jersey was saying that all of the male police officers needed to be clean shaven. And they did have one exemption, which is for medical conditions. And a common medical condition that might lead to an exemption would be something called folliculitis, when you shave and your beard area becomes inflamed. So Samuel Alito, who was then a Third Circuit Court of Appeals judge, wrote that if you're going to allow for an exemption such as folliculitis, you also need to have an exemption for religious reasons. And so there were these Muslim police officers who said, well, under our faith, Islam says that men shouldn't shave and that they should grow their beards long.
And so Samuel Alito said, well, if you're going to have an exemption for folliculitis, then you also need to allow Muslim police officers not to shave. And so I think the same kind of thing applies here, where if you're going to have an exemption, as Indiana and Missouri and Florida do, for cases where the mother's life is at risk, and some states with anti-abortion laws have additional exemptions for cases of rape and incest, if you're going to have those exemptions, then legal scholars would say, based on current court interpretation of religious freedom laws, you also need to have religious exemptions. So for those reasons, I think these claims are pretty strong.
Ironic that Samuel Alito, who authored the Dobbs decision, said that in this case that you referenced in the 90s.
Right. Yeah. I almost wish these cases were not in state courts, but in federal courts. So it could potentially go back before Samuel Alito in the U.S. Supreme Court for him to have to decide.
Right. So what is happening in these courts? Have the plaintiffs had any success?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. So, you know, we're talking about four separate lawsuits in four separate states. They're all kind of in various places. Kentucky's has not yet had a hearing, neither has Florida's. But Florida's case, which was filed first, way back right after the Dobbs decision was handed down, that will receive a hearing in early April. And then the plaintiff's lawyers tell me that they expect their case to have an initial hearing in the next couple of weeks. But the case in Indiana is actually has already been decided by a trial court judge who agreed with the plaintiffs, who said that the plaintiff's lawsuit saying that Indiana's strict abortion laws violated their religious freedoms was a valid complaint. And so the Indiana Attorney General tried to appeal that decision to the state Supreme Court directly and bypass the normal appeals process. But the state Supreme Court said no. And so what that means is that the Indiana case will proceed in the regular Court of Appeals, which will happen in the next couple of months. But then it'll likely end up before the Indiana State Supreme Court, because I predict that whichever side loses in the Court of Appeals will appeal that decision to the state Supreme Court.
Hmm. Well, I guess I'm wondering, what is the argument on the part of the state when they are presented with these arguments that a certain religious group, and in the Indiana case, that also involves a Muslim plaintiff, when they are presented with the argument that the law violates their religious beliefs, what is their response?
Well, one frame of their argument is that these religious beliefs are not sincerely held enough, which is really offensive to the religious plaintiffs arguing that these laws go against their religious freedoms. It's kind of insulting to them that a partisan figure would question their deeply held religious beliefs. So I'm unclear of how that argument will play out in the next round, which would be the state's Court of Appeals. But the trial court judge in Indiana said that that wasn't a valid response, that these were clearly deeply held religious beliefs.
Could this make it up to the Supreme Court, do you think, eventually?
I don't see a pathway for these cases to make it up to the United States Supreme Court because they're primarily using state constitutional grounds to argue their cases. But that being said, these lawsuits provide kind of a roadmap forward for other religious plaintiffs in other states to claim that their religious rights are being violated. And maybe someone in the future will try to make a federal free exercise or a federal establishment clause complaint that will go to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, thank you so much. This was a fascinating conversation, and thank you for your reporting on this.
Thanks for having me.
That's Abby Vasulis, national politics reporter for Mother Jones, where she's been covering groups challenging the Dobbs decision on religious grounds. Coming up, how food influences your mood and your emotional state dictates the food you want to eat. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. How happy do you feel when you eat a cookie? or a bag of chips or a fresh peach. We know what we put in our bodies has a significant impact on our physical health. Less understood is how food affects our mental health. And that's the subject of a new book by Washington Post writer Mary Beth Albright. She explores the relationship between food and mood, how what we eat affects how we feel, and the reverse, how our moods influence what we decide to eat, for good or ill. The book is called Eat and Flourish, How Food Supports Emotional Well-Being, and Mary Beth Albright joins me now. Welcome to Press Play.
Oh, thank you so much. Thrilled to be here.
Thrilled to have you. Okay, so confession, I would do almost anything to eat a chocolate chip cookie. I find it immensely pleasurable.
Oh, same, yeah.
I guess a lot of people feel that way, but some people don't. They prefer, I don't know, chips or cheese or whatever. So what's the science behind that? Why do some people find certain foods really, really pleasurable, almost addictive?
In humans, we have the same pleasure circuitry for all different kinds of pleasures, whether that be sex, whether that be listening to good music or watching good entertainment or food pleasure. And pleasure is a form of nourishment. And it's a form of nourishment that we can see happen in our brains. And one of the things I did was I worked with a Stanford researcher, Dr. Eric Stice, who does fMRIs, functional MRIs of people while they're eating. And so he does his research mostly on ice cream, but I was interested. I showed up at his doorstep with kale juice and wine too. So I spent an hour and a half in an fMRI drinking wine and kale juice and milkshakes, and how it's fascinating how your brain will show that pleasure, and that it's something that we can see. And this is also going into the idea of eating together, which is something I write about a lot. Book.
So I'm guessing that the kale juice center in your brain didn't light up as excitedly as the milkshake and wine centers did.
That's correct. And what's really interesting is he would show pictures of what I was about to drink before I drank it. So it also shows the anticipation. So definitely the kale juice was not lighting up as much. But when I saw a glass of wine, my brain anticipated, because, you know, I drink wine fairly frequently, my brain was anticipating that pleasure. And so when I actually had the pleasure, it showed up a little less in my brain. Everything works into what our food pleasure is. And a lot of us just think about flavor as being on the tongue, but it's really created in the brain.
But can we train ourselves to have that same excited pleasure for kale as we do for a cookie?
Absolutely. And well, I mean, look, the cookies, particularly with fat and sugar, those have different ways to your brain. So I talk a lot about the brain-gut connection. A lot of people think that about the nervous system is just in the brain, those neurons in your brain and spinal cord. It's not. It's all over your body. And your gut has its own nervous system called the enteric nervous system. And it's in constant conversation with your brain. And so the ways that you can start to create your own comfort foods, which we do every single day, but you can create those your own comfort foods by associating different moods and like happiness with certain things. And the book gets into that and about how you can use your emotions, intense emotions, and I have intense emotions, to recreate and retrain your brain for comfort food. Because there's always neuroplasticity, including around food. You can really
Right, but it's a hard job, right? When your brain is wired and your body is wired to respond so forcefully to fat and sugar.
That's right. And a lot of it gets into, and in the book, we get into this too, the gut microbiome. And that gut microbiome affects your cravings, affects your sleep, affects your social anxiety. I mean, they're doing these really fascinating animal studies on mice twin pairs, and the early childhood trauma that they can put a mouse through, which is taking it away from its mother, which is putting it in a maze with no end, that kind of thing. That early childhood trauma will change the microbes that are inside of your body, which then affect weight gain or loss. And so it's not the only factor. And I'm never telling anyone, you know, throw away your antidepressants, just use food. I mean, this is a tool in the toolbox that we have. And it's a tool that we now have a couple of decades of solid evidence that it actually works. And it's not just sort of like, you know, relegated to the world of complementary and alternative medicine, which is sort of like, oh, that's nice if you want to try it, but there's not really any hard evidence. There's a lot of hard evidence around food, including talk therapy, including medication. I mean, we're really looking for science-based ways to help people through the mental health crisis we're having right now.
So what is the hard evidence linking food to depression and anxiety? Are there certain foods that can work as well or close to as well as an antidepressant?
Yeah, well, one of the studies that I was just talking about, that early childhood trauma, what they wound up doing was giving the mouse with anxiety and depression symptoms a probiotic, which is just, they're live bacteria that are found often in yogurt. People will think about that. And the decrease in the anxiety and depression symptoms were equal to the antidepressant Lexapro. There's also a lot of evidence around inflammation, which if you eat a lot of ultra processed foods, you know, chips and things like that, industrial oils, those inflammatory compounds that go into your blood can then get through to your brain. We now know that that barrier is semi-permeable, and those inflammatory compounds can get through to your brain and wreak havoc with your emotional well-being. So eating a whole foods diet, I mean, this is not something you haven't heard before, right? You need whole foods diet, heavy on plants, not even plant-based, but plants, actual like fruits and vegetables, fatty fish, whole grains. A lot of it is around the Mediterranean diet, which I think a lot of Americans are very familiar with. And just eating those foods will reduce that inflammation, which will reduce your risk of mental health issues.
Well, how do these inflammatory agents seep out of the gut, if you will, and make their way to the brain?
Well, there are two things that we're talking about. The number one is the inflammatory compounds that go into your blood when there's inflammation anywhere in your body. And that could be from food, that could be from a cut, that could be from a broken leg, that could be from anything, right? But I think what you're referencing with leaking into the gut is that in early animal studies and now in human studies, they're finding that incidents of depression are often associated with gut issues as well, which is not surprising. Again, when you think about this gut-brain connection that we have through neurons, but also through other ways. And so the organisms living in your digestive tract, in that gut microbiome, what they eat is fiber. Remember, they're their own little beings. They are not human cells. They are microbial cells, and they need to be fed too. If you don't get enough fiber, those microbes will start eating the lining of your gut, the inside of your gut, because they've got to eat. They're starving.
And when the gut is the large intestine, just to be clear.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
That's what we're talking about.
Yes. I'm glad that you said that, because a lot of people sometimes
think of it as the stomach. Yeah.
When you talk about that, it's the entire digestive system. But where the action really happens is in your large intestine. That's where a lot of the magic happens, and a lot of the, you know, food digestion and medication metabolism, too. I mean, whether one medication works for one person, doesn't work for another, that is also dependent on the gut microbiome, as well as other things. But the gut microbiome is a huge part of it.
Okay, so when they start leaking out, that's when these inflammatory agents, or some of them, start making their way to the brain and cause these mood disorders. Can they cause something worse, like dementia?
There's ongoing research about all of this. And the thing about diet studies is that they are devilishly difficult to do, because unless you put a webcam on someone's head and record everything they eat, in science, every bite matters. The lick of the brownie batter matters. Everything matters. And so what we are seeing now is long-term group studies about it affecting dementia, about it affecting other types of brain health. It is strongly believed that it is a factor in those other things as well. But again, it's really difficult to do diet studies. And so that's why a lot of these things are done on animals first, then we go on to human studies. But it can cause all kinds of problems, these inflammatory compounds getting through to your brain.
So that study you referenced earlier about Lexapro versus a probiotic in mice, has that been replicated in humans?
No, it has not. And okay. that was a study out of Ireland, a man named John Cryan, who is at a university in Ireland that does significant microbiome studies. And I spoke with him at length about that. Now, what he has done, because again, with the mice, they're just eating pellets. You can make sure that they're all eating. So that's the constant. In humans, you have to do something entirely different. So what John Cryan has done in humans is there was something called the SMILES trial back in 2017, which showed that a Mediterranean diet significantly decreased depressive and anxiety symptoms in humans. And that was done in Australia. And then what John Cryan did was he took the SMILES trial and he added fiber, which is, as we were talking about, what the microbes eat. So you're adding in that fiber and then the microbes are getting enough to eat. And there was an even more significant decrease of Mediterranean diet plus added fiber supplements. Again, it's hard to replicate hard science in humans this way. To the extent that it can be done, it has been done. Mm.
So why is it that when we are feeling depressed, angry, sad, many of us don't want to eat, but if we do, many of us want to just dive into a tub of ice cream or something like that. Why aren't we eating something that is going to actually be more beneficial to us, that will strengthen the gut microbiome and the intestinal wall, like a plate of broccoli or something?
The human body and the human relationship with food is more than just, the body is more than a container of parts, and food is more than just something that goes into our mouth, as we all know, as you know, the book argues, it's all emotional eating. And so some of that goes back to our food memories and our comfort food memories. I talk a lot to Phyllis Richmond, who was for decades, the food critic at the Washington Post, and she is the person who is credited in the Oxford American Dictionary as creating the phrase comfort food. And this was, you know, decades and decades ago. I talked to her about it and about how those comfort foods are very culture specific and very sort of childhood specific. And that's why in the book, I talk about ways that you can sort of begin to retrain your brain to create your own comfort foods. We teach ourselves how to eat every single day. And I did not grow up with a lot of fruits and vegetables. And it's a process. And that's why the science is really exciting, because people always say to me, like, okay, what are the top five foods I should eat, you know, for my mental health? And this is not a eat 10 walnuts and you'll be fine in the morning kind of situation. It's about a healthy eating pattern. And when you have that eating pattern over the course of, you know, weeks, months, years, your body can withstand other things. So if you're feeling really down, which, you know, I have had bouts of depression, can't get out of bed, and I get that. And so when you're feeling that way, it is important to try to make sure that you're sticking with some sort of a pattern to make sure that you're sort of buttressing your own system.
Yeah. So is there something, after all, you've done all this research and also you've had personal experience, is there something you just won't eat? You think, okay, even though we shouldn't be excluding things from our diet, there are some things that are just too toxic.
I really stay away from ultra high processed foods. And I have become like a vegetable convert, and it doesn't mean, you know, all my vegetables are steamed and that kind of thing. Like there were, you know, 10 different vegetables at our Thanksgiving table. I've become somebody who is okay with preparing vegetables in a delicious way, you know, because it doesn't have to be. Vegetables are not self-punishing. They're self-affirming. They're life-affirming. And another thing that I'm doing differently is I got new cutlery, because I get into that whole field of neurogastronomy, which is about how your brain creates flavor. And if you give the same person two meals, it's the exact same meal separated by a week or whatever. And one time you give them disposable cutlery, flimsy cutlery to eat it with, and the other time you give them heavy, high quality cutlery, they will always invariably rate the meal that they ate with heavy cutlery as more delicious and higher quality ingredients. So there's
that
little
makes sense.
Like. Yeah, it does. But it's like these little
and then that little detail you have about how coffee tastes better in a white cup.
Oh my gosh.
That.
Which is crazy. And even the guy who did that study, Charles Spence out of Oxford, even the guy who did that study, he was like, doesn't make sense to me. But every single time, coffee tastes better in a white cup than in a blue cup. We don't know why. But and that's the thing, is like there's so much we don't know about the human brain. So in the meantime, while we figure out the mechanisms, we can use this science right now to make our lives better.
Mary Beth Albright, her new book is called Eat and Flourish, How Food Supports Emotional Well-Being. Thank you so much.
Thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Okay, go eat something on some fine china. I'm Madeline Brand. That does it for us today. I'll see you tomorrow.